Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Nelson Warren, and I'll be the host of today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally in Washington, D.C., and in over 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to our website at hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is Barack Obama and the Future of Liberalism. Today's guest is Dr. Charles Kessler. Dr. Kessler is a senior fellow of the Claremont Institute, editor of the Claremont Review of Books, and professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. Dr. Kessler also teaches in the Claremont Institute's Publius Fellows Program and Lincoln Fellows Program. He received his AB in Social Studies and his AM and PhD in Government from Harvard University. From 1989 to 2008, Dr. Kessler was director of CMC's Henry Salvatore Center for the Study of Individual Freedom in the Modern World. Dr. Kessler is editor of Saving the Revolution, The Federalist Papers, and The American Founding, and co-editor of Keeping the Tablets, Modern American Conservative Thought. He has written extensively on American constitutionalism and political thought, and his edition of The Federalist Papers is the best-selling edition in the country. Dr. Kessler contributes regularly to the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal and The Los Angeles Times. His articles on contemporary politics have also appeared in the Washington Times, Policy Review, National Review, and the Weekly Standard, among other journals. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Thank you very much, Nelson. It's a pleasure to be here, my first time at the University of Utah. And I come in a spirit of thanks, or at least some sort of exchange, since I teach at Claremont McKenna College in Southern California, and the incoming president of our college is Hiram Chodosh, the dean of the law school here at the University of Utah, and I look forward to meeting him. I haven't met him yet, but I understand he's coming. He will be on our campus fairly soon. And so in the spirit of thanks and gratitude, I'm here at CMC returning the favor. I'm not staying, however. I'm just here for one lecture. But we appreciate receiving Mr. Chodosh and look forward to welcoming him to our campus. Well, I've written a book about American liberalism and Barack Obama. And the book is called I Am the Change, Barack Obama and the Crisis of American Liberalism. And the title, I Am the Change, is a little joke, I suppose you could say. It's almost a paraphrase. It's almost a quotation from one of President Obama's news conferences shortly after he had been elected president. It's a little play on I Am the State, the famous L'État c'est moi, of Louis XIV, and so it's designed to play up President Obama's Louis XIV side, as it were. It's a conservative critique, but a respectful one, I think, of the president and of the whole century-long tradition of American liberalism. Unlike many people many of my friends even on the on the right of American politics, I don't think it's really fair to understand Obama as something he doesn't, in a way that he doesn't understand himself. He doesn't call himself a socialist. He is not and does not consider himself a foreigner or a third world ideologue, as my good friend Dinesh D'Souza has painted him in a movie and two best-selling books. I think it's proper to understand him as a liberal, as a progressive, as a member of, in high standing, in the now 100-year hundred-year tradition of American liberalism. And so what I'd like to do in this talk is to cover both bases, to both describe the past of liberalism, where it came from and what it has contributed to American politics and what its essence, as it were, is. And secondly, to address President Obama's presidency and, more importantly, the future of liberalism in his second term and beyond. So those are sort of the two large topics I want to address. The crisis of liberalism, which I see in the future of liberalism, I will say, just to get ahead of myself slightly, I don't mean by crisis an emergency, a drastic emergency necessarily. I mean it in the old-fashioned sense of a turning point. I think in the not-too-distant future, liberalism is coming to a crossroads in which something transformative is going to happen to it. And it's not impossible, it seems to me, that liberalism could go out of business in American politics, or that it could transform into something more more overtly radical, or something that is distant from its origins and even its high point, which was probably in the New Deal, something more overtly something more social democratic, something that would involve a much larger percentage of the American GDP flowing through the national government. But we'll get to that. The first question I want to pose, the major question, is what is liberalism? Where did it come from? And surprisingly, it's been hard for conservatives and liberals alike to answer this question in the past 100 years or so. When liberalism hit American politics, it took a long time for our politics to know what had hit it, to recognize what was happening to it. Conservatives in particular have been at sea when it comes to trying to define their own opponent in our politics. Conservatives have looked at liberalism variously over the past 50 or 60 years as either a continuation of medieval nominalism, strangely enough, which was the theory of Richard Weaver from the University of Chicago, as an emanation of the French Revolution, which was a lot of people, beginning with Russell Kirk, perhaps above all, have held the essence of American liberalism to be a kind of transplanted version of Jacobinism into our politics. Some conservatives have indicted liberalism as an expression of the regimenting spirit of industrialization, the turn away from agrarianism and a farming economy to a heartless industrial one. Others have looked at it as a continuation of the universalist politics of the anti-slavery movement and of Abraham Lincoln. And a few conservatives think that Abraham Lincoln was the first liberal president, the founder of big government and of total war. Liberals, for their part, have had trouble explaining themselves, too. I think the prevailing account nowadays, if you ask a liberal or if you read books by liberals about liberalism, of which there are quite a few, the account that is now in favor is that liberalism really is nothing more than the spirit of bold, persistent experimentation. This is a phrase from Franklin Roosevelt that the president has himself recently used. That is, liberals tell themselves that liberalism is what works. It's the pragmatic approach to real problems of real people in real life, and that all it tries to do is to solve those problems. And in doing so, it's completely untheoretical or unideological. In fact, you could say it's downright conservative in a strangely kind of Burkean way, since what it's trying to do is keep our society together and evolving slowly and peacefully into the future. It's just trying to reconcile our political arrangements with our social and economic environment, the crises that society and the changing economy are always throwing up. From the liberal point of view, from this liberal point of view, it's the conservatives in American politics who are ideologues. It's the conservatives who have theories that they want to try to impose on the reality of American social life. And these theories range from trickle-down economics to originalism, you know, in Supreme Court jurisprudence, trying to read the Constitution as it was originally meant to be read, and many others. The only kind of conservatism that liberals approve of is therefore the kind that is most like liberalism, the kind that accepts the playing ground and the rules of contemporary American politics that liberalism has dictated over the past century and accommodates itself to those. So from the conservative point of view, the kind of conservatives that liberals like are losers. Those who have very small ambitions and don't challenge the liberal rules of the game but are content to play along by those rules, to continually be second place finishers in American politics. Now, this modest account of themselves that liberals have spun for many decades now is, of course, not completely true. It's a lullaby. Meant to lull Americans into a kind of complacency, into a kind of cheerful acceptance of liberal politics as they are. It's a little bit like, you know, the policeman by the side of the road, by the side of the wreck, who says, keep moving, there's nothing to see here. Don't look at this. Just pass on by. But if you stop and look at it, you might discover something new, something unusual, something shocking. And I think that's the case with liberalism. If we do stop and look at it, if we take a long historical view of it, what would we find? Something like this, I believe, that liberalism began almost exactly 100 years ago, emerging in the progressive movement that broke into American politics most dramatically in the 1912 presidential election. An election that pitted three men who all called themselves conservatives: William Howard Taft, who was the incumbent Republican, Woodrow Wilson, who was the progressive Democrat, and, of course, Teddy Roosevelt, who had bolted the GOP to run on his own ticket, the Bull Moose Progressive Party. I'm more interested in Woodrow Wilson than in Teddy Roosevelt, because Woodrow Wilson was both a theorist and a practitioner of progressivism. He had been, of course, for most of his life, a professor of politics and, for a while, president of Princeton University before he even began his political ascent. His first run for office, Wilson's, was in 1910 when he ran for the governorship of New Jersey, and by 1912 he was president of the United States. That meteoric rise is faster even than Barack Obama's. It is probably the fastest rise from non-politician to president of the United States in American history. And we have the advantage of his career-long writings on his critique of the American Constitution and of American politics, which he then, assuming the presidency, had ready at hand to try to translate into practice. So we don't have that with any other, really, figure of the progressive era. But liberalism, which began as progressivism, spread across American politics in three great waves during the 20th century. The first was the New Freedom, Wilson's administration. The second was the New Deal in the 1930s. And the third was the Great Society and its leftist critics in the 1960s. Each one of these waves set out to transform America, as the names of them, I think, suggest. Obama's wave, the one that we're familiar with, is really the fourth installment of this urge to refound American politics, to transform it into something different and better. We should notice that each one of these waves was halted. Each one really only lasted the breakthrough moments when sweeping social and political legislation were passed, really lasted only a couple of years in each case. The fact that liberalism at its height, at its most aggressive, can be stopped ought to encourage conservatives. But we also have to notice that in each case, in about a generation later, the transformative process renewed itself and began again. And that, of course, ought to encourage liberals and depress conservatives. Each one of these waves left a different legacy, and cumulatively, I think they have worked to heighten Americans' expectations of politics and to expand the ambitions and the powers of the American government. To try to turn liberalism back, if you're a conservative, to try to overcome liberalism is a very difficult task now, because it has been, this virus has been in the bloodstream of American politics for 100 years. And the American public has itself been reshaped to some extent by the effects of liberalism. And so to unwind it is not an easy task. It is not child's play to figure out how one might temper or moderate, much less reverse, the leading aspects of liberalism. But what are those aspects? Let me talk about each of these waves, and not too pedantically. I'll try to isolate in each case the signal contributions that each made to our politics and the lingering effect that each has had on contemporary liberalism. So let me start. I'd say these three waves you could talk about as political liberalism, economic liberalism, and cultural liberalism. And those distinctions are heuristic, mostly. That is to say, they are not terms used by these waves themselves, and each wave had its economic, political, and cultural aspects, but I think it helps to organize our thought to put these labels on them, because those are where the primary lingering effects of each wave are situated. So first, let me talk about political liberalism, the progressive wave. This wave imparted two new demands or two new concepts into the heart of our politics. The first is what Wilson called the living constitution, and we still today call the idea of the living constitution. And the second is what Wilson called and we call leadership. As I'll try to show in a moment, leadership is not a new term in politics, but leadership as a salutary thing, as a good thing, as a central concept of democracy, is new. And Wilson, I think, is the primary author of that concept, which liberals and conservatives alike now take for granted. So first, the living constitution. Woodrow Wilson was the first president to criticize the Constitution, and especially its theory, the theory behind it, as obsolete or time-bound. As a product of the 18th century and of 18th century ideas and theorists like Montesquieu, Wilson thought that the Constitution had been fine for its times, but by the 20th century, it was showing its age. By the 20th century, it was clear that the Constitution, in certain crucial respects, had grown outmoded, and it was going to be necessary to not simply to update it, but to completely change the spirit in which one understood it and applied it. And therefore, pouring new wine into this old bottle, one really has a kind of new regime or a new America, a new freedom that is quite different from the old freedom. What were the differences? What were the problems with the Constitution that Wilson saw? Well, first of all, the founders, he said, had assumed that human nature was static, that it was unchanging across the ages, that it obeyed constant laws of nature. He even said that the understanding that the founders had was Newtonian, expecting that even as the laws of gravitation and of action and reaction and so forth that Newton had discovered applied to inanimate matter, so the founders thought that there was a law of human motion which applied to human beings, and that law was self-interest. John Locke and Thomas Jefferson and Montesquieu, according to Wilson, all assumed that human nature followed a kind of iron law of self-interest, and if one wanted to construct a free government or a democratic government, one would assume that men were ineradicably self-interested and try to, play that self-interest off against itself. Checks and balances, separation of powers, all of these themes of limited government that, say, the Federalist Papers stresses is exactly what Wilson had in mind and what he had in his sights. The founders didn't realize, he said, that politics doesn't obey Mr. Newton. Politics obeys Mr. Darwin. And human nature itself is changeable, is indeed in some respects perfectible in something like the Hegelian sense. And so instead of a government based on permanent natural rights that constructs a constitution that itself tries to be permanent and as resistant to change as possible, you know, the constitution was made deliberately hard to change. There is an amendment process, but it's very difficult to get that machinery in motion. As opposed to that kind of constitution, you want one that recognizes the changeability of human nature, therefore the evolution of human rights, and therefore the growth of government. Government must be able to grow quickly. It must be able to adapt handily to new environmental challenges, to new social and economic problems, and it must be able not to divide the powers of government to resist bad government. On the contrary, it must rapidly be able to concentrate the powers of government in order to do good, in order to solve social problems. And it can only do this if, as I say, a new spirit of interpretation is brought to bear on the Constitution. It must be regarded as a flexible tool in the hands of experts trained in the latest social sciences who will be able to define our social problems and then set out to solve them. You need the same people, essentially, and the same kind of sciences to identify the problems that you need to solve them. And so you have a kind of symbiotic relationship from the very beginning between big government and the modern university. The two go hand in hand. The new social sciences were at home in the new universities of the United States that were established really just at the beginning of the, just at the end of the late, of the 19th century. And there was a kind of hand-in-glove relationship between these new sciences, the new schools, and the new politics that the progressives contemplated. The second factor that Wilson introduced into our politics, as I mentioned, is leadership. We need leadership. The problem with American politics, the problem with the old Constitution, in a phrase, is that it produced leaderless government. That's a direct quote from Wilson, leaderless government. And so modern American politics, liberal politics, must have leadership to lead us and to, you know, bring the Constitution along with us into a future that will inevitably be better than the present, even as the present is better than the past. That's really the assumption of progress. I mean, progressivism is one of those political terms that actually tells you something real about the people who sign up for it. Progressives believe in progress. That is, progress not as a possible thing, but as a kind of inevitable aspect of human evolution and human development. And they really believe in a progress that is not simply technological and scientific, but also moral and political. There are a lot of people, particularly one could say in the American founding, who believed in progress in some sense, and believed certainly in technological, artistic, and scientific progress, but yet who thought that human nature being the same, that one could not guarantee progress with humans, human matter, and human nature, because you always had in every generation to start over again. You couldn't transmit, you know, one generation's virtues or understanding of moral and political things to the next generation as you could transmit physics or chemistry or the latest discoveries in engineering to the next generation, because the problem of human passions, the problem of human ignorance remain salient on the moral and political front. Anyway, the old idea of leadership is well illustrated in American politics by the Federalist Papers. If you look up in the Federalist Papers, and there's a concordance to the Federalists, so you don't have to read every word to find this out, there are 14 mentions of leaders in that book, and 12 of the 14 are pejorative. A dozen times, the Federalist speaks with scorn and disapproval of artful leaders, factious leaders, leaders who mislead people, leaders who organize the passions of the people against the law or against the Constitution that they ought to be defending. The two exceptions to this pejorative use are the same. The leaders of the revolution, meaning men like George Washington, a few others that one, of course, could mention, but George Washington is typical, or is the height of the phenomenon. And for them, I think the exception shows the rule. Washington is a leader because he was leading before there was civilian politics, really, before there was a constitution, before there was the Articles of Confederation. He was a general waging war, a long war, for independence. And so leadership is something close to war, close to emergency situations, and necessary and good when properly conducted in those kind of situations. But for regular politics, for politics after you have a constitution and you have a representative legislature and so forth, you don't want the spirit of leadership, you want the spirit of citizenship and of statesmanship. And they use these words quite differently. The founders, in a way, took equality very seriously. The equality of citizens is based on the equality of human beings. And the task of citizens is to govern themselves in a civilian way as equals. The problem with leadership from that point of view is that you can't be a leader unless you have followers. I mean, leadership presupposes followership. Leadership presupposes an inequality between the leader and those who follow him. And for the founders, that is unrepublican, and it is potentially dangerous to the rule of law, to equality, to the civilian control of the military, even. But Wilson taught all Americans, liberals as well as conservatives, that leadership is a good thing and a necessary thing and a benign thing. And the reason it can be made benign is that he defines it as leadership for the future. That is, we need leaders to lead us into the future, you know, the next step into the future, not far into the future, but only the next attainable step. And to do this, two qualities are needed of the leader. And these terms also, like leadership, are now really central to American politics, but Wilson is the first one to introduce them. Vision and compassion, or sympathy. The leader must have vision, meaning the ability to see just beyond the curve of the river, to know what's coming next. And then he must have the power to transmit that vision to the people en masse so that they will be organized behind the leader and his party and prepared to march into the future or steam into the future more equitably, more efficiently, and more confidently. In order for that to work, the leader's vision can't originate in him. He has to find his vision in the people themselves. He has to extract it from the people. He has to sum it up from the latent and unconscious impulses in the citizens themselves. That's where sympathy or compassion comes in. The leader's voice must ring, the leader's ear must ring with the voices of the people, as Wilson says, meaning he must feel our pain. He must sympathize. He must have compassion. He must feel our passions. He must feel our pain. He must be able to make conscious for us something that is, in our individual minds, unconscious, namely what it is that we need, we desire, and what the future can deliver to us to satisfy our immediate needs and desires. So modern-day American statesmen, I mean, whether you're running for mayor or for governor or for president, now have to establish their leadership credentials. They have to persuade you that they can lead. No one thinks that that means we must follow. We are asking to be led. We're not asking to govern ourselves anymore, and that seems to me to be a fundamental distinction. So earlier American statesmen may have had virtues, but modern-day leaders have to have visions. And so since Wilson, we praise a politician's, and especially the president's, personal force or charisma, or his ability to, to mesmerize us and to organize us and lead us into the future, which is guaranteed to be a better place than the present. The second wave of liberalism in the 1930s, led by Franklin Roosevelt, what I've called economic liberalism, established at least two new principles also for our politics. The first is the term liberalism itself. Wilson did not call himself a liberal. He knew liberalism as what we would call classical liberalism, as the founders' ideas of natural rights, social contract, limited government. And for Wilson, that was precisely the kind of liberalism he hoped to move beyond, to displace. And so progressive was, in some respects, the enemy of that old liberalism. But FDR had the brilliant political insight that if he changed the name back to and if he took the old word liberalism from the opponents of progressivism and applied it to his own party, the Democratic Party, and the progressive faction within that party, he could achieve a great political breakthrough. On the one hand, he could connect himself and this new version of liberalism to the founding. And he could argue that just as the founders were liberals, so he and the Democrats are a liberal party, a party, he insisted, of militant liberalism. In the 1936 campaign, he gave a whole series of speeches, I think six or eight of them, on the subject of liberalism, the definition of liberalism. In the 1932 campaign, Herbert Hoover responded to FDR's attempted appropriation of the term by bitterly contesting it. Hoover insisted that he was the true liberal, the classical liberal in this race, and that FDR's doctrines were tainted by European fascism and by European collectivism of various flavors, and that FDR had nothing to do with the American founders or Abraham Lincoln or the tradition of American constitutionalism. Well, Hoover lost that fight, and our use of the term liberal now follows FDR's intentions. It follows FDR's redefinition of liberalism. At the same time, of course, it had the advantage of terminologically bollocksing up his opponents, right? And so if you can't be a liberal anymore, if you're a classical liberal but you can't call yourself a classical liberal, what do you call yourself? And therefore, the term libertarian enters American politics shortly after Roosevelt. Not a term really that had been used before, but it's a term that some of the classical liberals had to invent more or less to apply to themselves. And everybody else who opposed the New Deal was stuck with the term conservative. And they bitterly resented this. I mean, you can find Barry Goldwater in 1964 explaining that he really is the true liberal, and the Dems are the false liberals. But of course, he by 1964 had to accept the label of conservative. But it took a long time for people on the right or people in the Republican Party to accept the term conservative. It really doesn't happen until the 1950s, or begin to happen until the 1950s. The second contribution of FDR is more substantive, and this contribution really goes to the heart of our politics today. And that's the creation of a new kind of rights that the federal government will enforce and can only enforce by new kinds of federal programs. We call these rights entitlement rights or socioeconomic rights. I mean by these the kind of rights spelled out in FDR's Second Bill of Rights, as he called it. The right to a job, the right to unemployment insurance if you don't have a job, the right to a vacation from the job, the right to health care, the right to a decent home. All of these kinds of rights, which have, in the years since the New Deal, really taken a central place, as I say, in our political contests. Together, these new kind of rights that he wanted to introduce into our politics implied a new view of the social contract. And let me say something very briefly about this new view. The old view, pervading the Declaration of Independence, was that individuals had rights. individuals had pre-existing rights by nature or from God, and that when you entered the social contract, you came in with rights, and the whole point of the contract was to vindicate those rights, to protect them better than you could yourself alone in a state of nature. You come together, you form a social contract, which means you create a people or a society, and then by unanimous consent, and then by a second act of consent, you create a government by majority vote. That was the old theory. FDR's new view of the contract, which he spelled out several times, but most plainly in his 1932 speech to the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco, this was September 1932 during his first campaign for office, was that the social contract is really between the people on the one hand and their rulers or the government on the other hand. And the terms of the contract are these. The people agree to give the government power in exchange for it giving the people rights. So a very different kind of exchange. The people don't have rights. First of all, the people are not individuals. You know, the people are the beginning. There's no individuals before the people in this version of the contract. And so individual rights as such drop out. What the people have as a collectivity is power. They agree to cede that power or some of that power to the government in exchange for it giving them rights or liberties. Now, if any of you who know a bit of British history would recognize this as much closer to the Magna Carta than to the Declaration of Independence as a description of the social contract. Under the New Deal theory, individuals get whatever rights they receive as members of the people or of a subgroup of the people. So all individual rights are originally group rights that come to you as a consequence of the stage of your society and the stage of its evolution in time. The result of this new view of the social contract is what I've called the first law of big government, which is there's no reason to fear government under this contract. No matter how big it becomes and how powerful it becomes, the people come out fine because the more power government has, the more rights it gives the people. These are rights to socioeconomic benefits of the kind we've just been talking about. Government must become much more powerful if it is to guarantee healthcare, jobs, all kinds of socioeconomic benefits to every individual, every American who is a member of this people. It leads, of course, to a certain philosophical and certain practical problem. The philosophical problem is whenever you create a right, you must logically create a duty. And so the great unanswered question of the Roosevelt philosophy is who has the duty to provide the hospitals, the doctors, the MRIs, the medicines that you need in order to have an effective right to health care? Who pays for the jobs, the homes, the medical care, and so forth? And the practical problem, which I'll talk about more in just a moment, is that that problem, that philosophical problem, has become very acute in our own age. Our government is, in a sense, broke now. And we are unable to fund Medicare or Medicaid, but we have now adopted Obamacare, which is a third large medical entitlement. I think all the best estimates now show that far from reducing the cost of medical care and the cost to government of providing medical care, Obamacare is going to vastly increase it. And so the problem of how to pay for the welfare state, which used to be theoretical, is now becoming quite practical and even acute. Then the third wave. Here I'll say just very briefly something, mention three things. The first is the Great Society was in some ways the completion of the New Deal. It involved fleshing out, so to speak, what Arthur Schlesinger Jr., the famous liberal historian, called quantitative liberalism. That is, adding programs that guaranteed a minimum standard of living to every American, and these are programs like Medicare and Medicaid, both added in the 60s by President Johnson. But secondly, the third wave promised to move beyond quantitative liberalism, to out-Roosevelt Roosevelt, as one of LBJ's advisors put it, and to move into a new sphere for liberalism, which Schlesinger himself called qualitative liberalism, and which I've been calling cultural, or you might say lifestyle, liberalism. The point here is to move beyond, to make America a great society for the first time, you have to move beyond the materialism, the egoism, the selfishness, the capitalist ethos of traditional American culture. You've got to improve Americans' souls, not just their body or their bodily standard of living. And maybe soul is too old-fashioned a term. I think self is a more accurate term. You've got to be able to guarantee the spiritual fulfillment of every self, the complete self-development of every self. And so self-expression, self-creation, self-development, these new concepts enter our politics as goals, which you need programs in order to establish and to support. And these range from various kinds of affirmative action programs to multiculturalism to the whole range of new sexual freedoms that Americans discover in the 1960s and want to see protected and even funded in some respects by government. And finally, from the 60s comes a third thing, which is a certain tone of, I guess you would have to call it anti-Americanism in liberalism. And this is really for the first time that one sees this, I think, out in front. It comes in from the new left. It comes in from the marginal left, the hard left. But the middle of the road left, never succumbing to it, nevertheless finds it hard to resist. And the logic of it is something like this. From the very beginning of what I'm calling liberalism, from the progressive era, you had progressives like Charles Beard, who wrote his famous book about the economic interpretation of the Constitution. You had many progressives saying that American politics had been unfortunately dominated by an oligarchic elite, by the rich. And the rich had corrupted, to some extent, American politics, or tried to corrupt it. And the spirit of self-interest and of immorality, corruption, that one could see in American history really had come from the top down. It was trickled-down immorality into our politics. But beginning with the new left and the academic left and invading to some extent, as I say, but only some extent, the moderate left or the middle left, the new argument in the 60s was that, in fact, it wasn't an elite phenomenon at all. Corruption, lack of virtue, selfishness was a mass phenomenon, not an elite phenomenon. It was the people themselves who were at fault. The people themselves were, in a litany that would become familiar, racist, sexist, imperialist, and so forth. The South's massive resistance to desegregation was, of course, a part of this. The silent majority voting for Richard Nixon, not Hubert Humphrey, and voting, you know, twice for Nixon and not for McGovern. All of this convinced the left of the left that there was something fundamentally wrong with the American people. It wasn't just the Rockefellers and the Vanderbilts. It was the average American who was racist, who was selfish, who was cruel in his heart. And when liberalism turned on the majority, by the end of the 1960s, the majority began to turn on liberalism. Now, President Obama, to come to my second topic, Obama confronted this frayed liberalism from the 1960s. He also had to face one new political reality undreamed of by previous liberals, and that was the amazing success of Ronald Reagan or the Reagan Revolution at the end of the 20th century. You know, Reagan's both the economic success of the 80s and the 90s, but the postulates that lay behind it, the emphasis on limited government, you know, on interpreting the Constitution in its original sense, in liberating entrepreneurial spirit and the capitalist ethos, all of that caught liberalism by surprise. They had not anticipated that such a dramatic shift to the right in American politics was possible, much less that it could happen and sort of control the high ground of American politics for almost 30 years. But that's what happened. And Obama, of course, Obama ran against Hillary Clinton in 2008. But Obama had a beef with Bill Clinton that goes back much farther than that. You can see this in Obama's second book and in his speeches when you read between the lines a little bit. He holds Clinton in a certain contempt. And that's because he thought Clinton had been cowed by the Reagan Revolution. He had conceded. He had given up. And so the result in the 1990s had been, moving liberalism to the right, surrendering to the postulates of a renewed conservatism, triangulation, which was, according to Clinton, the only way that liberalism could survive and go forward in the 1990s, meant compromising, accepting something like the permanence of the Reagan Revolution and steering accordingly. Obama disagreed with Clinton and thought that the Reagan Revolution was not here to stay, that it could be overthrown, that it could be replaced by an Obama revolution. And the somewhat vacuous terms that bannered his campaign in 2008, hope and change, were actually very precise and accurate, because what Obama saw himself as doing was reviving liberalism itself, which he felt was in crisis and on the point of extinction or surrender to conservatism. And in order to revive liberalism itself, he had to convince liberals to hope again for big change in our politics, that big change was possible, that something like the New Deal or the Great Society, big, bold breakthroughs, not small ball, not school uniforms, not midnight basketball, not the kind of initiatives that Clinton had pushed in the 1990s, big things could be accomplished again. Just because Hillary Care, which was the initial big initiative of the initial big program that Clinton launched, ended up crashing to the ground in flames, did not mean that the cause of universal health care was forever lost in American politics. And that's exactly what Obama did in the first 2 years of his first term. He led something like a new deal. He not only had a massive re-regulation of the financial sector, somewhat in the spirit of the New Deal in the Dodd-Frank Act, massive spending in the stimulus bill, but most importantly, his victory on Obamacare showed liberals themselves that you could have hope in progress again. You could be a progressive again. You could be a liberal again, believing that you are on the right side of history, or at least that you could dictate what history was going to be. You didn't have to accept it as a conservative fact. And as I say, I think that Obama succeeded in his goal. He has revived liberalism. He has restored the confidence of liberalism as a kind of crusading power in American politics. But that doesn't mean that the future of liberalism is rosy. I think that this revival is probably going to prove temporary, and for two reasons, which I will quickly enumerate so we can move on to some questions. There are two large problems, it seems to me, face liberalism now going forward, which Obama himself cannot completely evade. One is fiscal. The other problem is philosophical. First, the fiscal problem. I've already alluded to it. Who pays for the welfare state? The notion that it's a social insurance scheme, that everyone pays for it. You pay your premiums and then you get your benefits just like in a regular private insurance policy, doesn't hold up to serious analysis anymore, and people are beginning to realize that. The young, according to polling data, have widely believed for almost a generation now that, for example, Social Security will not be around when they retire, or that if it is there, it will be minor, a shadow of its former self. They may be wrong about that, but the realities underlying that pessimism are that people realize that the beneficiaries are extracting much more than they ever contributed to the program, on the order of two or three times what they ever contributed to the program, and that the program is funded on a pay-as-you-go basis. But the medical entitlements are much more problematic than Social Security, which is fixable. I think Social Security is pretty easily fixable. But paying for Medicare and Medicaid and Obamacare going into the future is exceedingly difficult, almost impossible, it seems to me. The president himself has now conceded something like this by admitting that into his budget for the first time that there would be a cost of living adjustment in the formula for Social Security going forward so as to begin to rein in some of the costs in that program. But that doesn't really adjust the major cost drivers, as I've been saying, on the medical side. And so if not everyone pays, if this isn't a scheme solvable by social insurance models, who does pay? And often liberals will give the impression that the rich can pay. You have to raise marginal tax rates and you have to eliminate deductions and so forth in an attempt to bring in more revenue from the rich. But the problem is the rich don't have enough revenue to pay for the welfare state ad infinitum. And so practically speaking, who pays now? The young pay for the old. But that can't go on forever because the economics are unfavorable. So the situation liberalism faces is what the late, great Mrs. Thatcher famously said concerning socialism. The problem with socialism is that eventually you run out of other people's money. And liberalism is about to run out of other people's money. Finally, on the philosophical side, Obama is a child of the 60s. Literally. He was born in 1961, and he very much shares, I must say, the 60s kind of existentialist mode. He didn't experience the civil rights movement directly, but he experienced it vicariously. And his whole childhood growing up was a kind of vicarious re-experience of the 60s, in the 70s and even as late as the 1980s. He shares the civil rights movement's determination to make history rather than, or to shape history, that's his favorite formulation, rather than to let it happen or to count on it to be just and progressive. And as a child of the modern academy, I mean, he was marinated in the modern academy a long time. At some very liberal places, and of course he taught at the University of Chicago Law School part-time for over a decade, so he, in many ways, the only job he held before he became a politician was as a professor in the academy. He had a short experience with community organizing, of course, but he left that, and I think he left it to go back to the academy for good reasons. Anyway, the postmodernist academy is something that he is very familiar with. Postmodernism denies that there's any objective truth or rightness or justice. There are no objective standards for right and wrong out there. We have only our own will and our own subjective values to give life any kind of meaning. I don't think he's a thoroughgoing postmodernist, which is fortunate for him and for us. But you can see the influence of these ideas in his first book, Dreams from My Father, which is his autobiography. This is a very unusual kind of memoir for a politician to write. I think we all understand that politicians often are notoriously untruthful when they talk about themselves. But never before has a politician writing his, or would-be politician writing his memoir, admitted that he was making things up in the book. And Obama admits this in the beginning of Dreams from My Father. He says, I've changed people's names. I've combined characters, you know, two or three people into one. I have changed the chronology of my life. I'm not, these things didn't happen necessarily in the order in which I describe them. In other words, this is a very postmodern memoir. This is the story of Obama's self-creation. It's not the story of Obama's actual life. It's the life that he would have liked to have, or that the life that would give meaning to his search for meaning. And it's here, it's with that kind of sentiment that Obama goes far beyond old-fashioned liberalism. In his second book, The Audacity of Hope, Obama says that the thought uniting all defenders of democracy is the rejection of absolute truth. Absolute truth, he says, is the mother of all fanaticism. To be morally certain of yourself is the same, is almost the same as being a fanatic, as being a proponent of the jihad or the gulag or the extermination camp. He says that in almost that many words. What happens then to the self-evident truths of human equality that underlie American democracy? What happens to Martin Luther King and his speech in 1963 at the Lincoln Memorial? What happens to all men are created equal? What happens to judging people by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin? Obama is actually very far from Reverend King on those subjects. If you compare Obama's speech about the Reverend Wright, which is really a speech about race and religion in American politics, to Martin Luther King's speech in 1963 at the Lincoln Memorial, you will be very surprised, I think, by how noncommittal, evasive, and unpersuasive Obama is when he talks about the ideals of America or the principles of the American tradition. But he's almost forced into that stance if you begin by saying that absolute truth is the absolute path to fanaticism and to immoderation, indeed to despotism. And it's especially a quandary when you are absolutely sure that absolute truth is the road to fanaticism and despotism. He is involved in the kind of self-contradictions that are very familiar to anyone who studies postmodernism. And fortunately, he's not a thoroughgoing postmodernist. I think he is a decent man. He has a sense of justice and injustice, but I'm not sure that he has a ground for his feelings about justice and injustice. I don't know that he has the kind of case that Martin Luther King or Abraham Lincoln or Thomas Jefferson could make for the sense of justice and injustice that we're used to in the United States. And in any case, his confusions about truth, combined with the traditional liberal impatience that I've been describing with the Constitution and its forms, seems to me augur a harrowing future for liberalism and perhaps for America itself. Thank you.
Concludes today's broadcast. Please join me in thanking Dr. Kessler for an excellent informative forum.